If you're standing up, it's not
standing up. Now you can also tap line. Okay. So I'm going to talk about inflation from Axiom Monopoly. This is based on some work I did in August with Eva Silverstein and Alexander Westphal. And let me start out by saying the reason I'm doing this on Blackboard is I hope you'll interrupt me and redirect things and allow me to slow down in the confusing parts and speed through the boring parts, et cetera. So please do ask a lot of questions. The plan is to start with some motivation and background. I have to put in a little bit of that because I think we're not all exactly on the same page in terms of what it is that one is attempting to do with inflation and string theory. I think that still needs some justification, even though people have been working on it for some time. The aims don't always get communicated completely, so I'll take one more stab at that. Then we'll move on to talking about axions in string theory, what axion monotony is, and I'll present to you a model, the predictions of the model, and then I'll conclude. So let me start out with the goal. The goal of the talk is to present to you a model of inflation in string theory. With some specific properties that are desirable properties. Notice the particular ones I want to focus on are, one, the model is technically natural, in a sense which I will explain, and it predicts a detectable level of primordial tensor perturbations, which is interesting for a reason that I will recall. So, briefly,
why is the second one a goal?
So,
I mean, maybe those perturbations aren't there.
Right. Yeah. So the thing is, if tensors are going to be seen, they'll probably be seen in the next decade or so.
Yeah.
And so if we're ever going to make models that do predict tensors, now's the time. And so one could say
But it's not that this model then is a better model than one that doesn't.
No, absolutely, absolutely not. However, if we didn't have any models that predict tensors, we'd be in an interesting situation.
Exactly.
But perhaps an imperfect one, you really want to know whether the theory can predict things.
Is falsifiability.
This model is distinctly falsifiable. It's falsifiable specifically because of the tensors in particular. Okay. But what I'll come to when I start talking actually about the sense in which it's natural and as I go through the motivation is the sense in which the models that predict tensors actually tend to be much more sensitive to Planck scale physics, and hence string theory is much more relevant for these models than it tends to be for other classes of models. So that's actually not an observational reason, but I'll come to that in a moment. Okay, so briefly, inflation, as we all know, is a quasi de Sitter epoch in the early universe with the line element involving exponentially expanding spatial sections like this, where h is the Hubble constant, is approximately constant, slowly decreasing, let's say, during inflation. And this is a very highly successful mechanism in GR plus TFT for solving the horizon and flatness problems. And it makes two generic predictions. And those are spectrum scalar perturbations. And a spectrum of tensor or gravitational wave perturbations. So there is a simple physical picture for inflation. It's probably very, very familiar. The simplest Lagrangian capable of giving inflation, some have argued, it takes the form of this, a single, let's say, real scalar field with a canonical kinetic term and a potential. So this is just a slow roll model. And actually, the model I'm going to tell you about today happens to be a slow roll single field model. That's what we get when we turn to this particular string theory configuration. It's not that this is the only class that's worth investigating. However, it is the only class I'm going to be talking about today. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about the predictions. So since this is a cosmology talk, I think everyone knows what the power in scalar perturbations is. This is, roughly speaking, it's the magnitude of the two-point function of the scalar curvature perturbations. And it can be written in a power law ansatz like this, some amplitude at a not very important pivot scale k star times a power law k over k star to some power ns minus 1 plus additional terms which I will omit that represent a deviation from this pure power law. And these sorts of anisotropies are visible. This sort of perturbation is visible as temperature anisotropies. And the result from the theory of inflation for P sub S, the power in scalar perturbations, takes this form. So here I'm just setting notation, reminding you of things which I believe are familiar to some extent, and you'll see why in one moment. Okay, so that is the spectrum of scalar perturbations. Now let's briefly talk about the tensor perturbations. The power in tensor perturbations, instead of involving this factor h over phi dot, which comes from the conversion of inflaton perturbations to scalar curvature perturbations, the spectrum of tensor perturbations only comes from the plain old fluctuations of a scalar field in this inner space. And the relevant fact is that the observable quantity is not the tensor power itself, it's actually the tensor power over the scalar power, which I'm going to henceforth refer to as the LR, the tensor to scalar region. Yeah. Comment is that we know the power in scalar perturbation because we've observed it. Let's say the Kobe normalization tells us that. So if we then can detect the tensor to scalar ratio, we would then be able to read off the energy scale of inflation because the power in tensor modes depends only on the Hubble constant in Planck mass units and are no other dynamics, no other assumptions. Modeled independently, this would then tell us what the energy scale of inflation is. So that's another reason why, this is one of the primary reasons why detecting tensors themselves is interesting. Now, let's get to why it's actually microphysically interesting for a model to predict. So now I'd like to tell you very briefly about the life bound, and that will conclude the lightning review of slow roll relevant facts and slow roll inflation. So if you just take the expressions I give over there for P sub T and P sub S, you can see that the LAR, the observable quantity, the tensor to scalar ratio, is 8 phi dot over h on Planck, phi squared. And so I can use the fact that the differential of the number of e-foldings is equal to the Hubble constant times the differential of time. So you convert this into and rearrange it into the following integral, where delta phi over m Planck is the integral along the number of e-foldings from, let's say, the CMB scale to the end of inflation, dn r of n. So what I did was substitute, convert the phi dot there into a d phi dn, and rearrange to get delta phi over m phi. So this is a possibly very familiar relationship. It's relevant because it tells you something quite striking, which we can find out by evaluating it. So this is approximately equal to r cmb over a times a number which is somewhere between 60 and 30. Depends on how rapidly R diminishes during inflation. Okay. In slow roll, it does not change very rapidly. So one can conclude from this the result due to Lai in 1996, which is that delta phi over M Planck is greater than or equal to the number of order 1 times the tensor to scalar ratio in CMB scales times divided by 0.01, also 1/2, That's highly important because R approximately 0.01, and roughly speaking, the level of tensor to scalar ratio that we're pretty sure we can distinguish from above 4 grams. And going way below that, say to 10 to the minus 3 or so, it becomes an issue of some debate whether we would ever be able to detect it. Moreover, this is the level that we'll be able to detect in roughly the next 5 years, maybe 10 years if we're not that lucky. So if we see tensors in the sky, we'll know that the infraton moved over a distance larger than the Planck mass.
Assuming we can't count Nicola's the action in a way.
Good. So the relevance of this for microphysics is now the following. So I think you're referring to the problem about corrections to the action that are suppressed by Planck, right? Yeah. Well, so let me come to that now. That is the reason that I bothered with the light band now. So in inflation, quite generally, there's a very serious problem, as presumably you all know, of trying to arrange that the inflaton potential is flat enough for slow roll inflation. But that problem is dramatically increased in large field models of inflation. Inflation in models of inflation which this left-hand side is at least one. So let me explain why that's true. So the simple problem is arranging for this quantity defined to be eta to be much less than 1, and for the gradient square of the potential in Planck units divided by b squared to be much less than 1. So we call that 1. And here, much less than 1 means roughly 10 to the minus 2. So that in itself is not such a big deal. You might say this is a tiny little fine-tuning. You just need the potential to be a little bit flat. So why are we at all worried? But the reason that we become worried, or the case in which we become very worried, is the large field case. So in any case in which the inflaton moves over a super Planckian distance, one starts to worry about the following problem. I mean, after all, what we're doing here is effective quantum field theory coupled to general relativity. So let's
What happens to the bound when there are multiple number of scalar fields?
When there are multiple scalar fields, at each time when one of them is providing the downhill direction, you can use that one to do the integral for that infinitesimal moment, and then you just keep doing that. So if it's sort of trading off, then you can. The total distance that's moved in the net field space is still given by this. On the other hand, if all the fields are excited at the same time, providing collective excitation, then just rename the collective excitation a single scalar field. That scalar field will obey this step.
So what's constraint on R, C, and B now?
The constraint on R, C, and B now is R is less than 0.22 from WMAC5. And it doesn't look to get enormously better from, this is going to improve from a couple of experiments, spider, over quiet, and a variety of others, the balloon experiments and ground-based experiments, and then ultimately perhaps in a dedicated CME satellite.
This is the CME 4 3 and 5.
Pardon me?
Delta 5 changes for the 3 and 5. It's not,
right,
you
it's saying
one super Planckian, but it's not very different from.
From order one times
right.
The Planck. That's correct. That's correct.
At least, yeah.
It's not vastly super Planckian.
Right.
However, that's true if you go exactly to the observational bound. The models one naturally writes down tend to have the property that the displacement is actually about 10 times that Planck, or usually a little bit bigger. And the important point is that we don't know at all that the Planck scale is a good cutoff. You might need a much lower cutoff. Certainly in string theory, you generically need a lower cutoff. So that's why. So let me make the EFT statement, and then we should indeed argue about what the proper cutoff scale is.
So that's model independent. So
yeah.
that
this relationship.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's just as long as it is single field, that's always.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So if there are n scalar fields, is there a factor of n multiplying the left hand side?
So if there are n scalar fields, it would be root n. So for example, if you took let's do the simplest case: 1/2 d phi squared d phi I squared minus m squared phi I squared. Sum from I equals 1 to n. Then you can define a collective field phi, which is defined to be the square root of the summing, well, it's just the summing quadrature. Then you find that the displacement of delta big phi is greater than over m prime, will still be greater than or equal to order 1 times RCMB over 0.01. But whatever microphysical knowledge you have that told you that maybe these little phis shouldn't move over more than a Planckian distance will be shifted by a square root of n because you've done Pythagorean addition here, effectively. So this idea was first introduced in the inflation paper by Demopoulos Kutcher. So the bound's the same, it's just that you might not be as worried by this left-hand side being bigger. So that's, in fact, it's a mechanism on that general sort that I'll be describing. Okay, so now let me make the statement.
Wasn't that mechanism the assisted inflation?
That's correct. It's kind of assisted inflation.
So that was before the inflation.
The enlarging of the range was never undertaken in the previous works by Littlemus and Bernstein. So assisted inflation for sure predates inflation, and the idea of having multiple fields together to collectively inflate is from that gate. However, attempting to add distances in quadrature to get around the light bound is for inflation.
But the corrections that you worry about, wouldn't they be larger if you have n fields?
Let me talk about what those corrections are, because I'm going to have a reasonable in field theory way of getting rid of those corrections, and that's what the talk is effectively about. So ineffective field theory without any specific symmetries. So one of the things is to write down an effective field theory Lagrangian and not yet assume any symmetries. And of course, the data of an EFT effective field theory Lagrangian is the field content plus the symmetries. So next, I'm going to have to tell you what symmetries I want to assume. I'll start with none, except the most trivial Z2, phi goes to minus 5, so I don't have to write terms powers of phi. And I can write an effective Lagrangian density of the form, let's say 1 half d phi squared minus n squared phi squared minus quarter 1 phi to the fourth minus a sum over an infinite series of non-normalizable terms corresponding to powers of phi suppressed by powers of cutoff scale lambda. So lambda is some as yet unspecified. That's not all. I should also add higher dimension corrections to the Gnag terms. For example, something like this, sum k equals 1 to infinity of nu sub k partial phi to the 2 plus 2k over lambda to the 2k plus, perhaps terms with even more derivatives. This is a reasonable starting. And what you've been referring to is the fact that if the inflaton displacement is large compared to lambda, then you have no right to neglect these higher order terms. That's certainly true. If those terms are present, if these lambda k's are order 1, then if phi is bigger than lambda, a simple description involving a couple of terms in this potential is manifestly useless.
But some problem, somewhere in between going up to here, you assume that there is a slow roll. So slow roll will put severe constraints on coefficients in this direction. You'll see.
You're right, but for the purposes I'm now taking, that would be assuming the answer. So I'm going to ask, does there exist a Lagrangian that's suitable for inflation without dramatic fine-tuning? And we know that you can do 1 in 100 fine-tuning for small field inflation.
But you don't mean the slow roll inflation when you do.
Fine. If you're not doing slow roll inflation, there's an analysis which has not yet been undertaken, to my knowledge, where one actually has to think about all of these terms. You still have to fine-tune the kinetic terms. So I'm going to be simple, and I'm just going to fine-tune terms in the potential and do slow roll. If you're doing DBI, you had better think about these.
So you are assuming the slow roll.
Sure, I'm assuming slow roll, but I want to stress that what is occasionally said, which is incorrect, is that by not doing slow roll, you can avoid the fine-tuning. That's false. You just shift the fine-tuning from the potential to the kinetic terms. It's certainly true in the DBI case, where we're on some of those terms.
If you're going to say that you're going to study a large field inflation, which is a slow roll, that already will put constraints on lambda k.
Sure. If I write down generic lambda k's, it won't work.
Yes.
That's the problem. That's the problem that needs to be overcome. Sure. Asserting that I want the terms to be absent is not, I think, adequate.
I guess what you're saying is that you will give a general, sort of an actual model which will satisfy whatever the constraints.
So the simplest version of the constraints is that these lambda k are negligibly small. And you can easily think, in field theory, how you would describe such a situation. You would say, the system enjoys a symmetry, right? It enjoys perhaps a continuous symmetry. So let me write down I will write down for you right now a symmetry that protects the system from all of those terms. Phi goes to phi plus constant. If the system happens to enjoy a continuous shift symmetry of this form, then all of those terms are forbidden. There's no trouble whatsoever. Of course, so are these terms forbidden. So I'm back to a theory with just derivative fractions. So the general picture, however, is that I wanted to stress the importance of having a really realistic, a really robust way of taking on these terms. What is occasionally done is when it says, well, let's hope the terms are not there, let's try and fine-tune them, this infinite series of terms against each other. I don't think that's really reasonable given the complexity of this series. I think what really needs is a symmetry argument. And that's been clear for awfully a long time. I mean, I think it was clear in the 80s, for example, in limit history. Okay, but what I want to do is explain to you why that is not something that I personally would be quite happy doing in effective field theory alone. The comment on this score is, what is this lambda? Well, if lambda is much less than implied, the problem gets worse. So let us conservatively assume that lambda is of order implied. Okay. If lambda is of order implied, what these terms represent is stuff coming from integrating out Planck's field degree. A shift symmetry that forbids these couplings is a statement that you're forbidding your theory from coupling to degrees of freedom of the Planck scale. And I don't think that's a particularly reasonable thing to do in an effective field theory that is manifestly agnostic about the nature of the Planck scale.
Since string theory is in your title, you're treating M string as M Planck, or you're distinguishing between
them? Right. So what I'm making now is the general argument that one has to be sensitive to the physics of the cutoff, and that it can be, as in general inflation, it can be as bad as sensitivity to Planck scale stuff. That's the argument for introducing string theory. Once I introduce string theory, I will definitely distinguish it.
Okay, good. Because even if you have string scale stuff that you integrate out, that could, spoil.
I would be completely dead still. So here I've made a very conservative assumption. The best would be that lambda's order and Planck. Then I at least don't have to worry quite as much.
But in string theory, you can't get
it. It'll be much lower in string theory. So in string theory, even more so, I need a symmetry. But the argument I'm trying to make in the last same minute is one that I think is important. And I think it's the main motivation for attacking this question of large field inflation in string theory. The argument is, if you assert that these terms are absent, you are making a statement about how the implicon in your theory couples to Planck scale degrees of freedom, which means you're asserting you know something about the Planck scale theory. So you better have some theory of Planck scale physics in which you can show that coupling is absent. Okay, so now I'll do that for you in string theory. Are there any questions about the motivation? Okay, let me summarize what I want. I want a shift symmetry phi goes to phi plus constant that is weakly broken by a single term in the potential, which I'm just going to call a phi all by itself. So if I wanted to do this for quadratic inflation, that's not the model I'm going to talk about today, but if I did, I would say that the symmetry forbids all of these terms and is weakly broken by the presence of a mass. Then if the mass is small, the whole thing is technically natural. The smallness of the mass controls further corrections. Now this is the version of the argument that indeed Linda has been making for about 20 years. I think it holds up. It's the sensible way to do things. You produce a shift symmetry. Let me stress that, to my knowledge, Linda has not phrased it in quite as clearly on the basis of shift symmetry per se, but the argument has always been that if these terms are absent and the mass is small, then that configuration is radiatively stable, which is surely what you want. So whatever term I do have that breaks the symmetry, if it's small enough, it won't reintroduce problematic corrections. That's the idea. And the symmetry should be approximately respected at the Planck scale. And here I'm going to put quotes around Planck because as Simeon commented, it should really just be approximately respected at a suitably high cutoff scale, and string theory is not Planck scale and lower. Okay?
I think you're giving Lindy too much credit, isn't it? You never said it that well.
I don't want to, since the argument is so straightforward, I don't really want to take away from the fact that this is effectively what Lagrangian has been proposing for a long time. But let me say there are some other people who deserve credit for this that include Kawasaki, Yamaguchi, and Yamabita. And Stu Kalash and Prokushkin, as well as Demopoulos, Kashrou, Drudy, and Lacker. So these are some of the authors who, in my mind, come quite close to using this kind of continuous shift symmetry to protect the inflow time
protection. Weren't the natural inflation people the first one?
Yeah, so I'm going to come to that and give them due credit. What I haven't yet mentioned is axions. And for the later of the talk, I'm going to be giving you a realization in string theory of axion inflation, which is indeed due to Freeman and Momenta. So yes, they will receive due credit.
They were like decades ahead of something.
Yeah, in 1990. Yes. The point is, however, that I wouldn't call it a trap. I think it was certainly the right way to start, but they didn't have any data about this cutoff. So they assumed something which I would say we can't quite find in string theory, and I'll give you the closest thing I can get to it.
I don't think I'm still following. Right. So you said there is a symmetry, fine, but you said you add terms that break the symmetry. So so what guarantees that it's a perturbative treatment? It's a well-defined treatment.
So the point is that if you have a symmetry that's weakly broken by one single parameter, say you just added one, it has only derivative interactions, and you add just I don't know a quartic interaction, then you have just one vertex in your theory that doesn't involve derivatives. And All diagrams you can make are going to involve powers, positive powers of that lambda coefficient. So if it's small, then you can count in a straightforward way how small all higher corrections will be. And one can do this systematically. The way you would do it for this kind of model is you would say for something like, if v equals mu to the 4 minus alpha by the alpha for some positive power alpha, then you can estimate that the corrections to eta coming from the corrections to the potential go like, for example, v squared over m times the fourth, and higher powers of v over m times the fourth, not v phi squared over m times squared. So I haven't had time to, and I won't have time to go through a treatment of the eta problem in general. A presence of a term like this generically gives the inflatonic mass over Hubble. This term is forbidden by the symmetry. The only allowed terms are terms of the form in this assumption, lambda phi to the fourth squared over m pi to the fourth, et cetera. So this is not allowed where this is. And one can check that this is small enough to not
come. So you're saying as long as there is a symmetry, you can add any term that you want?
No, as long as there's a symmetry that's weakly broken by one term, and the coefficient of that term is small in an appropriate sense. So here I have to assume that mu is small compared to m pi.
Mu is small compared to m pi.
Okay. So in Linde's quadratic inflation treatment, the point is that m is 10 to the 13 GeV. If you tried to do inflation with m of 10 to the 18 GeV, it would not be stable.
That's rather unnatural. All you really need is for the coefficient of the breaking, to be some power of g depending on the number of legs in the term, right?
You don't need it to be parametrically small, or
You need it to be small, but it's just as good to have g squared, g phi to the 4. And then also a phi to the 6 where with some higher power.
You're absolutely right. I could add a lot of terms as long as they all effectively come counted with the same power, with enough powers of the small parameter.
That's right.
That's completely right. So what I'm doing is the simplest. You're totally right. What we're going to end up seeing is something that only has this leading one, at least just.
So that's weird, isn't it? And that really is unnatural.
Let's see. Okay. Good. Actually, let's definitely come back to this as soon as I present that term, because I think you may be right that those other terms actually do appear and are non-harmful but present. So that's an excellent
point. Since you've been slow down this argument, the potential argument.
Yeah.
So there's actually two expansions you did here. The number of the low energy expansions and the possibility of a derivative expansion. And then and then large fields, you want to demand things that the potential is sufficiently flat that you don't get a lot of energy costs for large fields, like you've got in supergravity models, say where you've got correct flat corrections of things, very shallow extensions. And so, so it's kind of, then when you do the expansion powers of phi, that's where it's difficult to think about the large phi limit, because you're, the second expansion in the powers of phi is something which is not necessarily organic to the low energy expansion, but it's kind of a generic way you could parameterize these functions that are in your low energy theory. And so do you accept that there, that, that an example where this analysis wouldn't apply would be things like through the radion, where it can be that, say that if phi had been the canonical variable describing an exponential modulus, then the natural expansion of the potential would be in powers of e to the minus phi. And so that large phi could be a controllable expansion, but not one which is well captured by a series of powers of phi.
And the reason that this is, has a different treatment is, for example, you might say that the Killer potential already contains a log form, which is effectively the resum or something like that. What, that's the kind of structure you're referring to. I know, in fact, why you bring this up, and was hoping to discuss this with you in the afternoon, and concerning the idea.
I'm
not sure I understand completely enough in this case, though.
I'm thinking more mundanely of it. Yeah. If you just mentioned or do something, you typically get things like dr dr over r squared as a kinetic term for these radius modulus, you know, the radius modulus. And then, right. so then if you're looking at a large volume limit, the natural expansion we're looking at is in powers of curvature.
Sure, I'm expanding here in the canonically normalized field, though. If I were doing this for r, I would turn r into log rho.
So then the thing is that it sounds like there's two separate assumptions, right? One is the low energy limit, and the other one is that the expansion powers of phi is actually capturing the physics of the microscope.
I'm attempting to describe this in terms of an effectively Lagrangian that can be treated at least around some point in phi space in a Taylor expansion in positive powers of phi.
Right.
And that assumption is almost always true at some point, but it can, of course, fail.
But it's almost always bad in the large phi limit, right? So that's your generic point, is that. But it could be that
it'll behave in sense of all these terms being present.
Yeah, but then the lesson might not be that it was the assumption that you could expand at phi that was the bad ones. Right? You could have perfectly natural physics that giving you a potential which is giving you inflation, and it looks like it would have been difficult to get in this analysis. But what's failing in the analysis is the assumption that you can capture things in powers of phi.
So in the end, the Lagrangian that I'll write down will have the property that the real determinant of cosine terms, etc., which you wouldn't necessarily have wanted to describe in just an expansion, you would have wanted to sum them up.
Yeah.
Okay, but it will still be true that the leading physics is governed by, not by assumption, but by dimensional reduction, is governed by a couple of polynomial terms. Right. So, in fact, by a single monomial term.
In your case, I accept that, yeah. But I'm just asking if you see the possibility that this could be missing something, this analysis, this low-energy analysis, in particular this.
Well, I personally think that that's, the most exciting case is a case where one can demonstrate to an effective field theory that something is missing from the effective field theory treatment. And
so it's not missing. It's not missing from the effective field theory treatment, but it's the assumption specifically in this way of explaining it. The thing that's failing is that the domain that you're capturing properly from the microscopic theory is well captured by a series of powers of phi, which is not a low energy series necessarily. It's consistent with the low energy limit, but it's not required by the approximations being made in the microscope.
Where the proper description would be in terms of some more general functions for what?
Well, yeah, like an exponential. And the concrete example is this case of large volume, because then it's a natural thing to do is a 1 over radius expansion. But in terms of canonical variables, that's an expansion power of e to the minus phi, and power of phi, which is perfectly good in the large phi limit. You're more and more in the regime.
Nevertheless, I mean, to my knowledge, I think we're getting to a discussion of a slightly separate point, but. In the large radius limit, the expansion of the effective action in most magnifications I'm used to does have 1 over r terms, a series in 1 over r.
Right.
Not just exponentials.
Exactly. A series in 1 over r, the kinetic term is dr dr over
r. Is exponentially related to that, I understand.
Yeah, so that means that in terms of the canonical variable which you're using, it would have been a series in the expansions.
Yeah. So, I don't think I have anything particularly useful to say about that point.
But you're not violently opposed to it, as I just
said. I am firmly opposed to it in the Lagrangian I'm going to describe, because I do the dimensional reduction. I won't do it all for you, but it follows that it can be described by this form.
Yeah.
But I think it is interesting to find cases that are not at all described as. However, I would think that there's a description in terms of some symmetry, even when that.
Yeah, there might be.
Right. And I don't think that would be possibly the most efficient way of understanding whether that structure is really robust. So what I'm going to give you here is something that has symmetry structure.
Right. The candidate in that case would be higher dimensional general covariance on the dimension.
or something. Yeah, well, this is exactly the thing. I remember the point.
Yes.
There may be a sense in which the point that, say, you are focusing is more generic than the points set out to be, is very good. There is the evidence in the capable initial words, in the variable R.
Ah, okay. I see. And that's actually a good point. So, okay, so you're saying that really it really is related to the log structure of the Taylor potential, that the fact that you can do this expansion in exponentials in your case.
Or there's maybe some divergence in coefficients of some R variable.
Yeah. So good. Yeah, so this is definitely something I'd like to understand properly sometime soon. Let me press on. It's maybe not everyone else wants that particular point, especially because I can't communicate very effectively about it. So let me try and talk about the case where I do know the proper description, and it does fall into this category. So the point is, what are we looking for? Let's remember, we're looking for a case that has a continuous shift symmetry broken by, let's say, 1. Now, if you want, in other words, phi, the infoton, is a pseudo Nambu-Goldstone photon. Right. So this idea is well tested. The problem is, it's actually turned out to be reasonably difficult in some respects to implement it in string theory, despite the fact that in string theory we have a lot of pseudo Nambu-Goldstone photons. Lots of axions coming from dimensional reduction of the remote into the Schwarz E4 fields. So the thing about why, if someone asks you, find a pseudo Nambu-Goldstone boson infoton in string theory, would you immediately start thinking about that axions are a promising candidate, besides the fact that they're numerous, they enjoy all orders shift symmetries. And that's what's rare. It's not really that hard to find a tree-level shift symmetry in string theory, and to try and use that to protect the potential, but it's not enough. You have to protect the potential to all orders, and possibly even non-perturbatively, up to high scale stuff. So one is then tempted to think, oh, axions are going to be a promising way to do this because axions enjoy these all order shift symmetries. And so if you could find a way to make the infoton be an axion, you can do this. Should I say anything about the shift symmetries of the axions, or should I just press on and explain how to use them?
Press on.
Okay, so axions. Let's consider a simple example, the Noether-Schwarz two-form field P2, which I can write as a sum of four-dimensional fields Bi of x times omega I, where omega I form a basis for the two forms on the compactification manifold M, and bi are functions. And let's also take sigma I to be a basis for two cycles on M, with the property that the integral over sigma I of omega j is equal to, in a convenient normalization, alpha prime delta ij. So then you get a four-dimensional axion from the integral of b over sigma I, it's equal to alpha prime bi. This is the four-dimensional space-time field. This is the thing that's present in time dimensions. So upon dimensional reduction, you end up with this guy. So the 10-dimensional gauge invariance allows this field to shift, and that results in a corresponding shift symmetry of these fields. Bi goes to bi plus 2 pi squared in an irritating normalization, which is in the paper. Okay. So, why then do we not immediately take up the idea of natural inflation due to free stream and Alinta? Their proposal, you recall, was that useful non-potential could be a non-perturbatively generated term given by the fourth power of some non-perturbatively generated scale times, let's say, a cosine of a dimensionless axion field A, which clearly, actually, let me put it A over 2 pi, because then it enjoys the symmetry A goes to A plus 2 pi squared. If this is the potential, and the action is 1/2 f squared dA squared minus V, where f is a dimensionful parameter known as the axion decay constant, then it's pretty easy to study the possibility of slow roll inflation in this context. And one finds that, for example, the slow roll parameter eta is equal to m Planck over f squared. And that's only going to be small if f is large compared to m Planck. And therefore, if you boldly propose that axion decay constants can be as big as you want, you can do fine. You can make a very nice model of axion-driven inflation. On the other hand, from the point of view of string theory, it seems natural to ask, can we just compute these decay constants now and determine, are they ever big enough for an actual inflation?
So before you do that, if you just did that?
No, I have not done that yet.
Take that large value of f, what kind of, do you expand the cards near a equal zero and it looks like an m squared pi squared?
Roughly speaking, yes. Yeah, I mean, you can go a little bit higher up the hill, but you could also just expand it. And so that would be a satisfactory large field model, and it would be natural in the tactical sense. Because this too was this A here was a proposed axiom with some shift symmetry, and so if you believe that axioms exist with shift symmetries that have ranges that are large compared to M Planck, then the whole thing seems to hold together. Have a nice model. Okay. So in string theory, f is computable. And in the interest of time, I won't go through an example calculation, but it just descends from the normalization of the fundamental term, for example, h3 squared, which has some given normalization to 7 squared, all the parameter for it. And if you dimensionally reduce and work out what is indeed the prefactor of the derivative squared of the field B, you work out the axiom decay constant. So I can do that, but I have to get to the fun stuff. So let me point out an important result. So these were not the first people to compute axiom decay constants, but Bankstein, Fox, and Gorbachev were the first to note the important point that f is much less than m, is less than m Planck in known computable limits. And let me stress both known and computable. Either of these things could be changed today. But as far as what we can say sensibly right now, we do not know how to make a single axion that has a decay constant that's m Planck or greater. And roughly speaking, it's because f comes out like some power of f, let's say f squared over m Planck squared, comes out like some power of radius 1 over L to the number 1, where number 1 is positive, times v squared to some number 2, where number 2 is greater than or equal to 0, and number 1 is strictly greater than 0. Okay. So that follows easily by considering known examples. One can, for example, look through the more comprehensive Sperchak-Witten treatment, which was after a totally different result, but one can substantiate this claim there. Okay, so that seems to be a problem. Axioms just don't have a big enough range. They're periodic fields, but the periodicity is too small. They have symmetries, and we don't yet know whether that's going to avail us. So this explains why you can't get natural inflation in the old sense, natural inflation of 1990 in stretching, in currently known computable limits. So now let's improve on that situation. We're going to do two things at once. We're going to make D-brains break the shift symmetry. And we're going to enlarge the field range. What do I mean that enlarge the field range? Here, the range of A is 2 pi squared, so the canonically normalized field phi defined to be fa enjoys the range phi goes to phi plus 2 pi squared f. So then f tells you the range in dimension of mass unit of the canonical normalized. So you should think of it as some sort of circle, and the problem is the radius of the circle is not the ground. Okay, so the idea is axiom Monodry. And I refer you to a prior work by Silverstein and Westphal that used Monodry for inflation. But this discussion and the discussion in the paper I quoted at the start is self-contained. It's just that that was an earlier work on the same subject. So, okay, axiom Monodry. I'm going to introduce a D5 brand. Let's be specific. Consider type 2B on Calabi-Yau threefold. In particular, an oriental fold that has O3 planes and O7 planes. The relevant fact is only that I'm considering, the most relevant fact is I'm considering type 2B theory. Add 85 rank, wrapping some curve sigma. So some two cycle. The quality out, which I will name F. And what that does is reasonably interesting. Previously, the axions had a configuration space that was just a circle, and they had a potential that was flat at the perturbative level of an all-orders perturbative shift symmetry. When you add a D5 grain, that's completely broken, and the potential, let me just write the DBI part, is the tension of a D5 ring times the integral over spacetime times the integral over the Rath cycle denoted by these coordinates xc, and the familiar Poisson term, which is the pullback, well, the metric plus the pullback over 2. Okay, so that may not be so immediately instructive, but if you know this is just a two cycle, and I can actually simplify this determinant, and I can write it in the following approximate way, which captures all of the relevant structure. I can write it as a length scale to the fourth of relevant prime squared plus b squared. In other words, the data contained in this is, in g plus b, is the off diagonal bit, which is b squared, and the diagonal bit, which is the size of the cycle. The relevant fact is that this is manifestly non-invariant under the shift symmetry of these people. Now, I didn't go through the argument why there's an all-order shift symmetry for axions and string theory. Let me just state a sentence which captures the structure of that argument, and you'll see why it's violated here. The point is that to argue for the shift symmetry, one makes an argument involving the fact that the world sheet has no boundaries. Closed-string world sheet has no boundary anyway. And in string perturbation theory and a compactification without D-brains, the world sheets always have a boundary. Once you introduce D-brains, there's of course the locations of the strings that have boundaries, and the total derivative argument made in the old days by Wen, Witten, and by Guy and Cyber goes out the window. And the axiom shift symmetry is just gone. And the breaking parameter, analogous to this mu that I talked about before, is the tension on the brain that breaks the symmetry. So that's what's happened here.
It's not sense in which the history shifts. Is there a sense in which the history shifts symmetry stays an age symmetry? So the reason I ask is the fact that now it seems to get become the whole history shifts in trend also. So I'm a little confused.
Right. So it was a global symmetry in the four-dimensional description of the piece. There's also a sense in which it was never a good symmetry at all, because at least at the non-perturbative level, it was going to get broken. So
you know, the continuous one is
the continuous
right
one. You're worried about discrete gauge symmetry. I don't think that there's a remaining discrete gauge symmetry, but no, that's actually a good point. So I think there's none, but let us discuss actually. So what is the point of the monodromy here? So let me just mention monodromy quite generally means that if you go around a loop in what you think is the configuration space, you traverse a loop in the naive configuration space, there's a monodromy, you come back not to where you started, but to some new location. So here, the object that has a monodromy is the potential. Namely, there's a naive configuration space, which I could draw, I guess, as a circle, and the potential is a spiral staircase function over that circle. So this is the real configuration space is the spiral, but the naive configuration space just given by b between 1 and 2 pi squared is this base piece. Okay? So now this is a caricature to make the monodromy structure a little more plain. If I were really just going to draw the canonically normalized field phi, you would see that the potential has an asymptotically linear form. That's because when b is very large compared to this l to the fourth, this looks like the absolute value function. And it's smoothed out a little bit at the origin once this l to the fourth comes back. So that's the form of the potential. And now let me summarize what structure string theory hands us in this case.
Yes. Simply explain, what is the geometrical meaning of b? Because I don't really know.
B does not have what you would. There may be people that be slightly unambiguous. I wouldn't say it has any geometric meaning. I mean, it corresponds, I guess, to a complexification of the metric. But I would just interpret B as being a background field in space-time. It's a two-form potential with a three-form field strength that has, you know, the kinetic term that I wrote, and it contributes to the space-time curvature, et cetera. And it's a real physical field, but it's just not the metric, and it's unrelated to.
Does it have anything to do with the position of the brain or something?
It could be dualized in the position of the brain, but in this picture, per se, it does not actually have anything to do with the position of the brain.
I don't want to take you off topic, but I'm just curious. With potentials, which are, you know, kind of non-analytic, you know, and not just simple polynomials or something, you can run into problems with potentials like if you had an absolute value or something, you run into a kind of quasi-overshoot problem where you come down to the bottom and then you go onto the second shelf and you have sort of multiple periods of inflations with little readings in between, and the last one is very short.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the last time you don't get very far up.
So you're worried about the fact that even the non-analyticity here is only of a square root form, but you're saying it still might be the same thing.
Right? Well, if L is small enough.
If L is small enough, I will be in trouble for a different reason.
Okay.
And that reason will be, I mean, I can say in brief because I may not get there. There are non-perturbative corrections to the Kähler potential, which cannot be suppressed by any method known to me, which are dramatic in that case.
Okay.
So L has to be at least a few times alpha prime. And to be quite honest, we didn't think very carefully about the real reheating process. All we ensured is that there's enough symmetry to protect this thing for 60 folds, and then, you know, sort of hand it off to a future work on studying the reheating. So that's actually an interesting question rather than start bouncing around again. Okay. So let me try and cover the main points in the remaining 2 minutes. What do we get for the Lagrangian? We get the following. For the whole action, we get, in terms of canonical kinetic terms, something like this, where mu cubed is t phi alpha prime over f. So here, this is exactly the advertised structure where you have a shift symmetry that's valid to all orders that's then broken by a single term, or actually, something turns out there should in general be more terms, although it's not immediately clear to me what form those other terms will take. Okay, so the phenomenology of this model is easy to analyze, and one finds the following predictions, ns about 0.975, and r about 0.07.
So what's f in this formula, t5 alpha prime over
f? F is the Hessian decay constant, which can be deduced from all of the given chromatification data by dimensionally reducing the h squared.
So some function also t of alpha prime and I guess l.
Alpha prime g string and l. Okay. Yes. And any other discrete input parameters. It will depend on all of these quantities. So I mean, I did go through the derivation of that, but f is not a an intrinsic quantity.
Are we thinking that the f is it has to be bounded above by the string scale or something, or is it something?
F doesn't have to be bounded above by. It's actually an interesting point how big and how small f can be. All I demand is just that I compute f in terms of the various parameters and demand that those of the parameters that are control parameters should be satisfactorily large or small, respectively. So one finds that it can be a good deal bigger than the string scale.
Can it be bigger than the Planck scale?
No. It's parametrically separated from the Planck scale by this margin, which I suppose is, kind of parameters. Like this.
So it fits into that class.
It fits absolutely in those class. I mean, the sense in which I say that the model even exists is that, note that I can change T5 by an awful lot if I were just to work for T5. So the whole story could, this mu cube can be shifted a great deal independent of shifting f. So it's actually not that essential for the story how big f is. The only point is the following. If I have a picture like this, I'm going to draw this absolute value thing. What you should secretly think is that, I'm traversing the fundamental axion circle some number of times. We call it, nw, the number of times that it winds around its circle. It turns out that if you try and have nw to be too large a number, then you end up getting a lot of back reaction in the quantification. So that means that f can't be too small. There's a priori no upper limit on how many times you can traverse this thing. But it turns out in detail, if you traverse it too many times, then what happens is the following. This d5 brain, so now I have a d5 brain in some Calabi-Yau. The d5 brain lives here and wraps a curve. This ends up having so much b on it that it effectively looks like a large amount of induced D3 charge. And then induced D3 charge, as D3 charge wants to do, produces a throat around it. And you want that throat not to be too big and curved. And that tells you that you can't actually traverse this circle too many times. So I want to make two general comments. Let me take maybe 30 seconds to make.
That combination, though, is going to be independent of the string coupling, is that right?
Mu cube?
Yeah.
Let's see. For an NS axion, F is, so T5, of course, goes like one over G string, but F is, in Plankings, is independent of G string.
Sorry?
For an NS axion, then F over M5 is independent of G string. It's just proportional one over L. Okay. So for a remote axion, right. For a remote axion, it goes like, no, it still goes like 1 over g squared for a remote axion. So for either case, there is some g-string dependence. You can think of it as being the tension of the three grains that you're producing, or the induced three charge. That's correct. So the comments I want to make about this, I really want to comment that there is a subtle issue about whether the non-perturbative effects in the system spoil the shift symmetry. So actually, the story I told you right now is, strictly speaking, false, because I was talking about an NS axion for simplicity. I didn't want to S-dualize to a Ramon axion C2. And the problem is there's actually an eta problem for this B axion, if you non-perturbatively stabilize. That's a little bit subtle to get into, but the lesson I want to leave you with, the negative portion of the lesson I want to leave you with, is that even if you have an all-orders perturbative shift symmetry, it may not be good enough if you stabilize non-perturbatively. And in fact, that does come in and kill this model.
Stabilize me in the moduli.
If you stabilize the moduli of the magnification non-perturbatively, then you had better check that the whatever non-perturbative effects are contributing to the moduli stabilization don't also contribute to the inflaton potential. And in this case, they actually do contribute. However, if you choose instead to inflate with C2, which I can just replace all the C's with B's and everything else goes through the same except for some factors of G string, then there aren't any instanton effects that give that inflaton a problematic. And that's five, right? Sorry, when I said I switched things, I should also say I switched the D5 for now, it's fine. Okay, so the final story then, or the conclusion about where the scenario stands is, I think, I didn't tell you what all the pieces are, and I won't do so now because I'm out of time, so let me just summarize the upshot.
sorry.
Yes.
So I know you were doing kind of local analysis, right?
I mean,
it's not really local. So it's unique just in a single single D5 grain, right? On a compact LPL.
I need another one.
Sorry?
I need another one. Should cancel one contact.
Right. And so so my question is whether there will be additional contributions.
There are additional contributions to the potential, which is a factor of two. But you're absolutely right that every reading has to be included. So there's definitely enough time to go through that. Let me just sketch a caricature of what that might look like. Instead of something like this, I could draw instead. So one needs to work down the potential in order to make the energy scale low enough. So one needs then an NS5 redirecting a two cycle in some warp region, because otherwise the energy scale is M string to the fourth of a G string. But then you need an anti-NS5 in some other warp region. And one needs there to be a family of two cycles in between them. That's part of the conclusions that I'd like to say is, right now, once you incorporate tadpole cancellation, the ingredients look slightly baroque. At the levels of four-dimensional symmetries, it's not that baroque. It's very reasonable. So I think this is actually a pretty nice model in terms of the symmetry structure and the sense in which it realizes natural inflation, but there's a lot to be done to make sure that it's really properly realized in string theory in an honest way. Thanks.
So you said that because of the back reaction, there would be an upper limit on how many times you can wrap around.
Correct.
So that would limit how big 5 would be, right?
That's correct.
So and what is that?
It depends on how big the magnification is. So roughly, if you look like this, every time you wind the axion around, you generate effectively 1 unit of T3 charge. So the number of dissolved D3s is equal to the number of windings. But on the other hand, you want the number of windings times F to equal, it turns out, 11 and Y. Why 11? Because if you take this candidate action and ask for 60 folds, you need 11. So this is what you want, and this is the fact. And this gives a bad reaction of the form R to the fourth is equal to 4 pi G string alpha prime squared and D3, as in AES5 plus S5, base of AES-NG. So the estimate is if you've got a bunch of D3 grains sticking in some place, a reasonable guess as to how badly they curve, the region around them, is given by this. And so what one then demands is that R should be much smaller than the generic radius of curvature in your space. So if you just have to, you know, the burden is on me to, and we do in the paper show you that you can, arrange a compactification that's big compared to that scale when N is big enough to get 11 and Y. So we show that. It's non-trivial, actually. It's the most painful constraint of the model, but except for the ugliness of this tadpole cancellation constraint.
But I guess, so there is still a limit, and I just want to see how much are the parameters. So there is a maximum field displacement, right?
That's correct, although it depends on a slightly complicated way on exactly how you stabilize the modulus, because that will adjust exactly how big a space you can tolerate given on the parameters. So we haven't fully explored that. One possibility is to use the so-called large volume scenario at moderately large volume, not the exponentially large that is usually spoken of. And it seems like this constraint might be slightly weaker there. But we have not yet determined how big we can go. We've just said, well, at least 11. And if for logical purposes, you know, beyond 11, you'd be making stuff that's going to remain outside of the horizon anyway. So unless something happened to the late time physics, that's in a sort of unnecessary region.
So if you go back to your four-dimensional argument,
yeah.
How does this avoid, you know, what suppresses the higher power zone? Given that you've broken the shift symmetry, what suppresses that?
Mu.
So can you, how would you power count, I mean, the next term, the phi squared term, how does it depend on mu?
So the allowed terms are of the form mu cubed phi to some power alpha over lambda to the, let's call it alpha plus one over lambda to the four alpha. For some.
And mu, why does mu have to always be with phi?
Because the quantity that breaks the shift symmetry is really the brain tension. The brain tension times the axion depth.
So that combination of T5 over F is.
That's right. That's the kind of brain tension. So what I haven't, yeah. Maybe you have a comment actually about these other terms now, or?
No, it wasn't about this.
Oh, okay.
Oh.
come back to that. Okay, well, I didn't have a useful comment about this other term, so I didn't.
So I was just wanted to ask you about the S-dual of this scenario that you mentioned. I was confused, though. So you would replace the D5 range with an NS-bind?
Correct, correct.
But then, so then VQ would go as, so the tension would have 1 over G squared, but then wouldn't F also have 1 over G squared?
In Planck units or in string units? In Planck, I'm writing everything in Planck units.
Okay.
So in the Planck units, it has G strings always to the positive power. So, to a non-negative power. So F over M Planck will always go like G string to the 0 or positive over length to the positive. So I'm not going to answer, maybe I'm missing the point. So you both asked about this, the absence of G string.
What's the total G string counting in the S dual person? It seems like you have 1 over G squared in the tension up there.
True.
And then you have only positive powers of G squared in the denominator.
So it's 1 over G cubed, I guess. And you
right.
said that's
the coupling that makes F, that makes mu huge instead of small.
There's an important point, which is that I briefly alluded to this. Even if there were G string to the 0, it's still M string to the 4, which is way off for Kogi normalization. So I have to do something to it. And the only thing that I can think of to do is to warp it. So if I'm warping it, then I can pay as many G strings as I want, because I have an exponential to compete with that to suppress the scale. So this is better be an NS5 ring that's strongly warped, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 level of warping.
Okay.
In its tension.
So the G strings aren't even important.
Not so very. I think you're right that there are G strings in there for the remote X. I think it looks to me like it goes like 1 over G string cubed, but you can overwhelm that one.
And so if you calculate in your favorite regime, you put phi where inflation's happening, what's the energy density at that point? I mean, do you go through?
Well, I've dialed it for.
You don't have the same issue that Eva had where the potential at. During inflation and during horizon exit is comparable to the cutoff or the Fuchs Klein scale or the string scale?
No. I have the property that holds is the following. V is less than the moduli potential, which is less than M string to the fourth, much less than M string to the fourth. So.
And much less means it's suppressed by some powers of some one of your.
Well, there's some exponentials even.
Yeah. Okay.
All right, because this is just M string part where U moduli is coming from non-perturbative effects, and I endeavor to make the potential smaller than that so I don't decompactify, and doing that guarantees that it's small compared to the cutoff. So there's no problem with that. And what this is numerically, it's just set by code. I had to find the mechanism is working that allows me to set this energy scale below the moduli scale and hence below the time scale. Okay.
So your stabilization address might be such that you fix the size of your cycle, right? So it's
the wrap cycle, yeah.
But doesn't fix.
You're completely right. And the comment I made about the B field is that Euclidean D3 brains fix both B and its partner quality.
Exactly. So
Euclidean D3 brains do not fix C, because C only couples to D1s.
So in reality, you shouldn't be talking about this.
I shouldn't be talking about B if you're talking about C the whole way through. I just thought it would be better to start with B, especially because it's instructive that one might say, oh, I have an all over shift symmetry, this is going to be great. It's not great, it fails completely upon non perturbative symmetry. Cool.
So, something I didn't quite follow the non perturbative effects you were talking about, but naively over there, I would have thought there are world sheet instant lines.
Yeah.
They play a role, or they're
right. So in general, there will be PQ string instant contributions. And the point, however, is that none of those contributions can arise in a superpotential. They can only arise in the Kähler potential. The reason for that is it's relevant because in the Kähler potential, I have a large classical Kähler potential, which is the volume. And in the superpotential, I'm using non-perturbative effects. So I'm much more sensitive to any appearance of the inflaton in the superpotential than in the Kähler potential. Okay. Now I can show you that roll sheet inflatons, for example, don't appear in the superpotential. The argument is just that they're proportional to two-cycle volumes, e to the minus some two-cycle volume. And two-cycle volumes are not proper Kähler coordinates. That's not something like this, e to the minus t2, a two-cycle volume plus know, IV or something like this, is not holomorphic. There's no way of making it holomorphic by fixing up this part either. The holomorphic quantities are four-cycle quantities in 0.307 or intervals. So there just aren't any super potential terms proportional to two-cycle lines. So that's why I haven't included the Rolle scales.
Can you have supersymmetry with these brains you need, the five brains or the...
These are not supersymmetric. They actually break supersymmetry completely.
Then why are you allowed to use an argument using a superpotential one?
So this is sort of an additive thing on top of an existing macro. This is the counting parameter for the breaking of the shift symmetry and the break of supersymmetry.
But if I'm in a regime, it sounds like you're actually in a regime where it's not like you've sequestered away the supersymmetry breaking and the inflation's happening over here. Your inflation's actually right where the supersymmetry goes because it's close to this five.
Well, the thing is, the cycle in general lives, the cycle we're imagining is a sort of a family of two cycles that lives in lots of other places. So I don't think supersymmetry is badly enough. Let's see. This picture that I sketched, I'll cover, showing a cycle, a family of cycles, these are all supposed to be homologous. So most of the action is taking place away from the five grains, and the five grains are warped down. Whereas the axion itself does not warp down. So that's the sense in which the breaking is small.
But is supersymmetry broken everywhere on that?
It's only broken at the locations of the five grains. It's a supersymmetric background into which I add a five grain and a five grain pair.
Whereas the axion itself is in the ball.
Axion's up there. I mean, everywhere that the cycle supporting it exists, which by assumption here includes the ball. We didn't include that just to get around the supersymmetry thing, but it serves to do that thing.
And if you look at the profile of the zero mode, is it in this warp region, is it peaked into the throat, or is it
we didn't compute that. No, that's an interesting.
Because that had to do with how decoupled the reference potential was.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. And it would be very interesting to do that. The thing that held us back is we didn't have a concrete enough realization that was compact. We just had some non-compact models that didn't make it seem reasonable yet to compute this. So I think as soon as I get my hands on a compact realization, I had a property like this, I don't want
to. Well, the non-compact model is zero isn't even normalizable, I think.
So it's hard to, I mean, the best I could have done is take two non-normalizable, take two things that look like that, roughly speaking, and glue them together and try and do some calculation. But I mean, it's not clear that I would have learned from that. So because of that, I can't really answer your question properly, because I can't do that calculation.
So, your eta parameter is it would actually oscillate.
Yeah, right. So that's the subject of current.
So when you're saying what R is, what do you mean by that?
But no, for R, it's actually okay, because the scale of inflation is roughly constant. So there would be very tiny oscillations in R. And for NX, it's important. I perhaps shouldn't even have written it like this. There are two realizations of the model that I need. Okay? Those realizations are the following. One is the simplest one, the plain vanilla model. I don't claim this is the most generic model, but it's the simplest one in which there are no relevant non-perturbative effects. And you can arrange that by trying to stabilize a large enough volume that all non-perturbative effects are exponentially sparse. In that case, then it's just like I said over there. There's not much oscillation. What I think is the more generic case is relevant NP effects in the Taylor potential. And the worst case is relevant non-perturbative effects in Taylor potential and superpotential. And this case is basically dead. Or it's a case in which the symmetry does not suffice to protect the model. Okay. But in case two, you're right. Generically, eta will oscillate, it's all epsilon. And so what you expect is a spectrum of scalar perturbations that actually look sort of like that. And such things have been searched for, and we're working out the detailed predictions of this specific model and trying to constrain it. And it constrains to some extent the non-perturbative scale length. At the same time, there's a possibility of resonant production of non-Gaussianity. There's a nice paper by Chen, Easter, and Lin that points out that if you had oscillatory terms in the potential, then those can resonate with the oscillations of modes inside the horizon and produce resonant non-Gaussianity of the form of resonant that goes like, I think, cosine of log k plus some phase, or sine of cosine. So it's an oscillating non-Gaussian anti-Gaussian. So we're actively investigating those for this case too. But I think it would be nice to understand a little better. It's not clear whether this can be done in short term. These sorts of issues, these general issues about other effects here, so we can really know which of these is generic before we go calculating. But it does seem actually the model has three non-trivial predictions: ripples in the power spectrum, I mean, in the two-point function, resonant Gaussianity, and tensors. So easy to pull it out.
Do you have a dial that allows you to suppress ripples, or?
Yeah, it's the exponent. It's the Keller potential corrections have to be proportional to the exponential of the size of the cycles being mapped. So just try and stabilize that at larger and larger volume. Now, as you know, I mean, stabilization of blow-off cycles, say, is not completely off the shelf right now. So there are some limitations in our ability to really say, I guess we're sure we can do this. But it seems reasonable that when you find a way to stabilize, you'll be able to stabilize this at finite volume. If you then dial the volume, these things get exponential. So I'm not yet confident that it will fall into an interesting range. I can just say that generically there will be some level of effects. Yes?
I don't quite understand the number of winding.
Yes.
The action of living in the work and is propagating in the work while doing the propagation, does it get a impact on potential from the environment? I don't quite understand how does the number of winding appear.
Yeah, I think it's probably a bad notation. I copied the notation from our paper, but it's poor. All I mean is the number of times that the axion moves across its fundamental period, or if you like, the total amount of the total distance that the axion moves in units of the size of one period. There's no pi one effect. It's not really winding. The only thing that you could say is winding is that there's a naive configuration space, which is a circle. But the real configuration space is a spiral stair, and it's going up the spiral stair. So Nw just represents how many times it's gone around that.
I think your language is just mixing T to LB frames.
Ah, so which frame, which thing is in partially in a...
If you T dual, then the D3 brain charge becomes D1 brain. You know, the monodromy becomes geometric. And you're just shearing a torus multiple times instead of shifting a B field multiple times. Mm-hmm. And then you have a brain wrapping us up. Then the D3 brain charge turns.
Sure. So this configuration can be T-dualizing a configuration with two NS5 brains and a D4 between them. And this is the number of times the D4 winds the T-dual circle.
I think that's where that language originally came from. I mean, in Eva's original paper.
I think that's probably why that notation was used.
I have one question about the vacuums.
Yes.
At the minimum of that.
Yeah. It's dialable, yeah. I mean, it's the CC problem. It's not something which is
trivial. Then your inflation, you need to subtract that.
Yeah, so what I have in mind here is, so since I tried to do this in type 2B 0307 with fluxes, it's natural to try non-perturbative stabilization. And so non-perturbative stabilization begins, at least in the KKLE scenario, begins with a supersymmetric ABS vacuum with negative causal order constant. So I could just contrive that the brain anti-brain energy is comparable to that depth. So at the end, when there's no B field, but there's still the excitation from the brain anti-brain pair, that could lift me up to around Minkowski. It's a serious fine-tuning as in all such models, but it's at least contrivable.
It doesn't involve the potential of B field.
It doesn't affect the potential. Yeah, that's a good way of stating the point. The issue with the non-perturbative stabilization is precisely whether adding those two terms together corrupts the inflaton potential, and I can tell you that it doesn't for the holomorphic reasons that I sort of alluded to.
This is a good time to wrap up then.